You know ID in the D in the L day. ID in the D in the F E A. You know ID in the D in the L day. ID in the D in the F E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 228 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
The 2-0 Seattle Seahawks. It's football season, obviously. But it also, as we talked about a few weeks ago, but I think skipped over last week, it's fresh hop season.
There we go.
And the most eagerly anticipated release, I would say, of fresh hop season is Fremont's Field 2 Ferment, which came out last Wednesday. And we have it here with us.
Absolutely. This is a special field of ferment. I don't know if I remember exactly last year, but in the past, they've made four different varietals of field of ferment with different hops in them. This one, they settled in, they honed in on two of the best hops, and they said, that's what we're going with this year. Also,
correct.
They said, we're making it in tall boys, because if there's anything that's better than a fresh hop, it's 16 ounces of fresh hop.
That is accurate. Does it actually say on the bottle? I'm pretty sure it's the Centennial was one of them, right?
Centennial and Sabra hops.
Okay. I mean, I miss the Citra hop, obviously.
Oh, you know, I pine. I yearn.
That could be a note, is pine in there. According to their description of it, aromas of coconut, citrus, and peach dominate. Followed with other tropicals, fresh cut grass, there it is, pine, sweet aromatics, florals, and spicy aromas. The flavor is moderate bitterness and light sweetness come together in a medium body that is mouthwatering and recapital fresh.
Wow. The hops might even be too fresh. Have you had one of these yet?
I've had three of them.
Okay, yeah, so have I. Yeah. We've each been saving this fourth one for this podcast, but we were not about to not drink the previous three.
I mean, I already have a review of this, and I gotta say, preferred it is the individual hops in the past.
Really?
Yeah.
I've gotta say, you're wrong.
Well, not the first time I've been told that. I would say that my hot take is I found the two beers fresh hop IPA better.
Really?
That we drank on the pod 2 weeks ago. But that's a high, like, all fresh hops are great.
Mm-hmm. It's like teriyaki.
Correct.
Or like cookies, which we'll get to in a little bit here.
Is one of us going to compare ourselves to Toshi at some point? Only Zach Whitman can do that. And by the way,
he's the Toshi of comparing himself to Toshi.
He sure is. If you haven't listened to it yet, be sure to check out our Seahawks Patriots Sunday Night Football recap emergency pod with Zach Whitman, lifelong emergency pod fan, joining us to get hyped on that. It was a great time.
Broke the third wall.
We have a limited number of toasts this week. Michael Dixon named NFC Special Teams Player of the Week after Pete Carroll said he was like, it was basically perfect, his game, highlighted by that punt with no returner back for the Patriots that he dropped at the 5, and it just went straight up into the air, bounced and landed at the 2. You cannot do any better than that in terms of punting. Jacoby Mode is back. With that, then, since we...
Oh, that's the end of our toast.
I told you there weren't very many toasts.
The next toast?
I told you there weren't very many. I mean, Russ was named NFC Offensive Player of the Week after week one, which is... I have a complaint here.
Okay.
Why does the NFL wait to announce these until Wednesday? What are they doing all day Tuesday that they can't announce the awards? There's no games Tuesday.
There's probably a complicated review process, submission process, Pelton style, where there's ranked tiered voting and stuff like that.
You can't
get all that voting done in one day.
I mean, that would be a lot more complex, I'm sure, than the process for NBA and WNBA Player of the Week, with which I'm more familiar. But they managed to get that one out on Monday.
Wow. Good for them.
So.
And then I guess just to add to that, we've talked about hoping for justice for the murder of Breonna Taylor. which we saw today was not going to be the case, possibly not unsurprisingly. And I suppose now we can toast that hopefully some good will come out of this long term. We have seen on very, very small scales a couple of police departments getting some budgets lowered, including here in the city of Seattle, by a meager 5%. And hopefully, at the very least, police oversight and this continuing to be a conversation continues to happen for the next in perpetuity.
As long as it remains a problem. And I mean, hopefully it isn't, but realistically,
in this country, it's going to remain a problem.
I was going to acknowledge that. Unless we make changes, it's going to continue to be a problem. And there have been some changes, but not enough. So we need to continue to fight for that. And
there's certainly been more steam for changes on the other side.
Certainly need to continue to, you know, make that clear at the ballot box. Exercise your right to vote. All right, on that note, should we talk about Seattle food?
All right.
Let's start off with cookies. You mentioned them. I don't want to say discovered, because it's a place that's been around for a long period of time. I don't know how we were unaware of them. Lowrider Baking Company, we went for the first time over the weekend. It's a company that grew from pop-ups, basically, at various weekend you know, markets and things like that, specifically in the South End. I believe the proprietor is from Burien, and now two retail locations, one in the Central District and then one during weekends at the Georgetown Trailer Park Mall, as well as visiting various locations. They were out in Fairwood near you last weekend, but sadly we did not discover that until after I had already gone to Georgetown to pick up a dozen cookies.
They basically had a pop-up in your backyard, and you missed it. You looked right past it.
I followed them on Instagram entirely too late. I mean, I just figured it wasn't going to get any closer than Georgetown. So we each had three cookies. I guess you had four cookies from Lowrider, from what they have on their regular menu. We went with the s'more, which is this like just a Seattle thing? Because of Hello Robin, or does everywhere have s'mores cookies on all of their?
Well, they definitely don't call it a mackle s'more anywhere else. That I am confident of.
That is accurate.
I guess I don't know the answer to that. I'm not paying attention enough to national cookie places or local cookie places in other cities.
The listener maybe can chime in if they don't live in Seattle and know about cookies locations.
If where there's they live. More cookies. Elsewhere, it's like you need to have one in Seattle now.
It's a must. The birthday cake with sprinkles, a little different, like smaller sprinkles as opposed to like the full, typical. You don't think so?
They seem like normal sprinkles to me, to be honest.
I mean, they're not abnormal, but like the sprinkles on
Bell's cookies. It's a normal size sprinkle. Find a new slant.
Some sprinkles are bigger than others. Brown butter triple chocolate chunk. Of those three, which was your favorite?
The chocolate chunk with the brown butter. I mean, I take it back now that I'm thinking about it. The confetti cookie was my favorite. You put me on the spot because I was prepared to talk about the fourth cookie.
Oh, yeah. So you also picked up, they had like Pop-Tart cookies.
A Pop-Tart cookie, which is a filled cookie, which is not something that I've really ever come across. So it's like it's a fluffy cookie. It's almost scone-like. And then there's sort of like a strawberry jam in the middle. I'll tell you, it hit the spot this September without the fair around. And then it is frosted on top like a Pop-Tart. So it was
that
a little bit
delicious.
It was a little bit different than the other cookies because of how fluffy it was. You know, the other cookies didn't have – they were denser. They weren't big cookies in the way that the Bell's cookie is, right?
And not quite as gooey, I think, would be the – that's the defining characteristic of the Bell's. To me, it was hard to pick among these three. I thought they were all pretty much on the same level. Like you, I'm predisposed to like a chocolate chunk the most, but I also thought the birthday cake, the sprinkles, was very strong.
That one hit me. That surprised. I had that late. I had them all on the first day that we got them, of course. And the birthday cake one was a lot moister than I was expecting. It was downright gooey in the middle. And I think that one came from behind, as though I was least interested in trying. And that won of all four.
Well, there, you're welcome, since I decided to pick that.
I would have never picked that on my own.
I also got three cookies for our mom, Jan. Huh. She had the brown butter triple chocolate chunk and was confused as to why there was salt on the top of it, which, you know, she doesn't eat a lot of fancy cookies, as it turns out. That's pretty much obligatory. And then I forced her to give me her other two cookies if she wasn't going to enjoy them.
I like that it was forceable. She didn't offer. You were like, give me those back.
Well, I was just like, look, if you're not going to eat these, if you were this unhappy with the experience, then I'm eating these cookies, because I was much happier with the experience.
How would you rate these cookies vis-a-vis Bell's? Not that we need to do this at this moment, but I do think it is an important conversation to have.
I think of the cookies we've had this summer, and we've had a few different varieties, Bell's remain the clear favorite to me.
Bell's is undefeated.
Yes.
They're the heavyweight champion. They're the undisputed, never been defeated heavyweight champion as of now. I would be curious to try these vis-a-vis the Hello Robin cookies, though. To me, they were almost like a very good homemade cookie. Where, like, the Bell's, I don't look at that as, like, I could make this. I'm like, there is some sort of, like, there's some sort of magicianry going on with Bell's.
Magicianry?
Right?
I was trying that to word is, I think that word is magic.
I was trying to think of a word from Skyrim. There was some alchemy going on with the Bell's cookies. But the Lowrider cookies are like, these are just good cookies. But at the same time, I'm like, I could probably, if I had all the ingredients right and I worked at it for a while, could make these cookies at home, aside from the filled one. But that's kind of what they tasted like to me.
Are you trying to make a s'mores cookie at home?
No, and let me tell you, that is my least favorite cookie. Because I'll tell you what. Fuck artisanal marshmallows. This is the number one thing. Marshmallows, on the whole, are terrible.
Wow.
And it's just a puffball of sugar. They're disgusting. And I especially hate the sort of like thick hand-cut artisanal marshmallow.
Are you anti-cotton candy?
I'm not pro cotton candy, no.
Okay, I'm not sure I'm pro cotton candy either. Like, it's not my favorite thing, but if you're just against a ball of sugar, then...
I've been workshopping this anti-marshmallow take for quite a while, and I was telling Katie about it yesterday. Look, I'm reusing material on you. And Katie was like, I'm not a big sugar guy. And then Katie was like, you're talking about eating four cookies in one day.
You know, you're not.
She kind of got me there.
You're not a big internal consistency of arguments guy.
There's a difference, though. There is a difference with marshmallows. They taste like sugar.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. I mean, I'm not the world's biggest marshmallow fan, but I mean, have you not enjoyed s'mores?
I like all the different aspects of a s'more, but if the marshmallow is taking up too much space, or like, I wouldn't eat a marshmallow on its own.
You're killing me, Smalls.
I lean, if there's two different ends of cookies, there's like a buttery end and a sugary end, I'm heavily on the buttery end.
I would agree that I'm probably also on that end. But sugar is still
good. I didn't know this was an index we were coming up with today, the sugary buttery index for cookies. But it's true, right? Like, Bell's cookies are pretty buttery.
The buttery, gooey nexus?
Mm-hmm.
I'll get cracking on an R graph of that. Okay, the other thing we wanted to talk about this week.
I lit a candle just for this. I'm ready. Ready.
McDonald's has added spicy McNuggets, and obviously we had to do a review of them.
Had to do it to them.
this was definitely the first time I have been to McDonald's for like anything but dessert in calendar 2020.
Really?
Yeah.
That's wild to me. I mean, you don't have children who the only fast food place they can go to is McDonald's.
Correct.
You don't even have children at all.
That is also accurate. you had them first. What were your thoughts? Oh, that is a heavy sigh.
I don't know if I went into the spicy nuggets with particularly high expectations. I saw an ad the morning, maybe not the morning they came out, but I woke up and I saw an ad for spicy nuggets and I was like, oh yeah, I'm getting those today. There's no doubt in my mind. And so they serve them in six packs, right?
Well, they have several options. Yeah.
When I got it, they only had six. They expanded after that.
I got a 10-pack. I was basking in the warm afterglow of the Seahawks Sunday Night Football win. Got a 10-pack and a large fries.
I could have eaten 20 nuggets after that. So it was six nuggets for $3. So they're not cheap, these nuggets. And as a fan of McDonald's chicken nuggets, I got to say, I think it was a downgrade from the normal chicken nugget.
Yeah, I'm with you on this one. I really wanted to like it because, like, Wendy's spicy nuggets are stronger than their regular nuggets, which were off the menu for a period of time and then came back.
Chance the Rapper brought them back. Chance the Rapper has not put out good music in a couple of years, but he has done good work for the people.
Kudos to you on that one, Chance. Do you have a take on Wendy's nuggets vis-a-vis McNuggets? As a sidebar.
That's an interesting question. I think I put the plain McDonald's chicken nugget, then the Wendy's spicy nugget. I don't even really... And then maybe the Wendy's regular nugget. So all spicy is at top. Or no, McDonald's regular is at top, then Wendy's spicy, then McDonald's spicy, then Wendy's regular.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a spicy sandwich.
Yeah, I mean, there were bites of it I thought that were pretty good, where it was like, okay, this is like eating a McNugget with a little extra kick, which is nice. But there were other bites where it just tasted a little bit off.
I wonder if it's our, and maybe clearly you're not that experienced with a McNugget, at least in 2020.
Over time, I've eaten a lot of McNuggets, right? More than my share.
Like, we've all eaten hundreds of McDonald's chicken nuggets. Like, it's the chicken nugget that I've eaten the most of any chicken nugget in the world. I didn't really have feelings about Wendy's nuggets going in. I didn't know what to expect.
Did they have, like, the 89-cent six-piece McNuggets back in the day? Is that a thing?
Absolutely they did. And I feel like, great!
I feel like this was, like, when I was in high school and in the start of college, and easily, like, probably five of those. Or maybe they were four-piece for 89 cents.
Look, we've all eaten a lot of nuggets, but you get used to those nuggets, right? Like, it had to be markedly better to get you out of what you're expecting from the McDonald's chicken nugget.
I had not realized until you pointed out that they are, at least at the Boulevard Park McDonald's, 10 cents more expensive than the regular McNuggets across the board.
10 cents, that's all? Yeah. Well, I think at the Fairwood McDonald's, it was, I don't know what, I don't even think they have six pieces of McNuggets, but it was $3.19 for six nuggets.
I mean, they're more expensive than that at the Boulevard Park. $3.99 for a six piece regular, $4.09 for the six piece spicy.
That's really funny. You're paying an extra 10 cents for that.
It's a very bad McDonald's location near me.
Okay. So wait, did you have any other thoughts on?
I think we about covered it. They're probably worth a try, and perhaps they will get better over time. But I would say in the event that I'm going back to the McDonald's, which is something I do probably maybe twice a year to get an actual meal, I would stick with the regular McNuggets.
Here's what I did get, though, at McDonald's when I was there. I was like, we're going for it. We're doing the whole thing, right? And I told him that Huncho Jack sent me. And that was the Travis Scott meal at McDonald's, which was a revelation. $6 for a quarter pounder with cheese, with bacon, medium fries, drink, and a dipping cup of barbecue sauce to dip your fries into. What more could you ask for? This is a screaming deal. Like, that's almost as much as your six-piece nuggets is at that location.
I mean, it's about the same price as the 10-piece was, yes.
there are certain moments where you can have a fast food burger and you're like, damn, this actually tastes like a real burger. And the first time I went back, I thought that the Travis Scott meal was so good. I went back a second time, like 2 days later. I was like, damn, that was a great experience. And the second time wasn't quite as good. But the first time that I had it, it was like, it was a burger that lived up to burger chain, like a Lil Woody's. I was like, damn, this is like a good burger that I'm eating.
Well, that's quite an endorsement.
Oh, it was. I mean, they're selling out of these throughout the country. Like,
I didn't realize that.
They're selling out of ingredients. Like, this is it's a minor phenomenon. This isn't Popeye's chicken sandwich phenomenon, right? This isn't, you know,
wait in line for an hour.
Rick and Morty's Szechuan sauce phenomenon. Yes. But this is like, I mean, it's just a quarter pounder with cheese with bacon on it. But something about it, like, you're like, I'm eating the Travis Scott meal. Like, it works. The whole thing works. Even if you don't really care about Travis Scott that much. It's like, it is an impressive feat in modern advertising.
Yes. Advertising worked on you.
I had one more thought as it related to McDonald's.
Okay, I have a little Woody's thought. But...
Okay, yeah, let's come back to that after, because this is specific to McDonald's. I was watching the movie The Founder last night. Have you seen that?
I have not seen that. We got recommended that, right?
Did we?
Yeah.
I don't remember this. By whom?
By Corey from Little Woody's.
Oh, he recommended The Founder?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, it's Burger Chef approved.
Yes.
So the thing that I was struck by, I've only watched like the first 30 minutes or whatever, I fall asleep. But the thing that I was struck by was, so Michael Keaton, Ray Kroc, goes to the initial McDonald's location in San Bernardino, California. Ron Swanson meets him there. It's thrilling stuff. Ron Swanson's one of the original McDonald's brothers. But when they show the back end of the initial McDonald's drive-in, it looks almost precisely the same as Dick's drive-in to this day. I was like, this looks like a Dick's back there. And it was pretty incredible. I mean, I grant that they're both drive-ins, and Dick's is like a classic sort of 50s style drive-in, but like, you're seeing them flip the burgers in the back, and I'm like, damn, those look good. I mean, it's still completely removed from what McDonald's looks like now.
Right.
But like, I'm like, that's the fun part about when you go to Dick's. You can see people grilling real burgers right in front of you. It's incredible. And seeing that, I was like, number one, I'm hungry. I didn't just say I want a lot of burgers. I said I want all of the burgers you have. I was like, number one, I'm hungry. Number two, this looks like a Dick's.
Well, maybe someday we'll be able to see pimento cheese burgers. We'll see on that one. My little Woody's thought. I only want to touch on this briefly because you can't get it anymore. Their burger of the week last week was they had a birria sandwich. And now that we're on a birria kick after our successful visit to Taqueria, or to Birria Tijuana, I should say, I had to try that out. This was the traditional Guadalajara style, made with goat rather than beef birria. Yeah. So it was pretty tasty. That was a fun burger of the week, I gotta say. So hopefully they bring that back next year. That was pretty much all.
September 2021.
Pelton Cast live show. and the birria sandwich.
All right. Well, let's talk sports, because there's kind of a lot to get to.
Yeah, let's talk about sports. Let's start with the Seattle Kraken, where there's an update that there is not an update. Last week, when he was talking about the timetable for the start of the 2020-21 season, which has probably been pushed back to 2021, it sounds like, NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman was asked whether the Kraken's entry into the league will be delayed by the pandemic. His response, no, I want that answer to be as definitive as possible. They cannot wait to get started. The building is progressing, and we have every reason to believe they will start when we begin the season after next.
So they're going to play another season, likely, which will be whenever, January to the summer, right?
And then the season after that, the 2021-22 season.
Then the Kraken start.
Correct.
Okay, so we still have to wait out one more hockey season.
Yes.
Wow, I look forward to not paying any attention to that and then starting to pay attention. There's a Stanley Cup Finals happening. I'm like, I saw that TBL was in it, and I was like, I ran the regressions, and I was like, oh, Tampa Bay Lightning. Boom. Nailed it. I don't know who they're playing, but I know that might be one of the teams.
I just learned. Oh, Dallas. They're playing Dallas in
the finals. Oh, big hockey town. Big hockey town.
All right. So there you go. That was just a weird question, because I don't know why you would assume that they would – because first off, by 2021-22, if we aren't able to have fans in arenas at that point, I would say that something has gone horribly wrong.
Have you seen the United States of America?
Well,
Something has gone horribly wrong should be our motto.
Tragically,
right?
Many things
have gone.
Give us
your weak, your poor, something has gone horribly wrong.
Tragically, many things have gone horribly wrong, but fall 2021 is a long, long time from now, and it's probably going to be like December at the earliest that you could actually start a season if the next season is delayed. So, but also, even if there weren't fans for some reason, they would still start playing games. I mean, that doesn't make sense. That why would they not play games?
Yes, they would be the same as any of the other teams.
Let's move on to the Mariners, who played their weekend series last weekend against the Padres in San Diego due to air quality concerns in Seattle. Ended up losing 4 of the 5 games that were moved from T-Mobile Park. They were back home this week and took 2 out of 3 against Houston, but still find themselves 3 games back of the Astros with 4 games to play. Those they'll finish up in Oakland and have fallen a half game behind the Angels for 4th in the AL West. Because Houston owns the tiebreaker, which is not usually an issue in baseball, but is there's no tiebreaking extra, in this case, 61st games, I guess. The M's must win out and the Astros lose out to have a chance at second in the AL West. They are still alive in the race for the second wild card, but are 3.5 games back of the Blue Jays there, though they do own the tiebreaker against Toronto.
There we go.
So basically we're in, you're telling me there's a chance territory right now.
The Astros' magic number is 1.
Correct. At least vis-a-vis the Mariners. I don't know what it is vis-a-vis the Angels. Seattle Sounders. A big win last Friday at home against LAFC 3-0. They mixed things up after beating LAFC 3-1 in both last year's Western Conference final and the meeting those two teams played at CenturyLink Field earlier this season. Then lost some of that momentum on Wednesday night in Portland in a derby match against the Timbers, losing that one 1-0. It was the in that LAFC game, Nicolò Lodero converted a pair of first half penalties, followed by Raul Ruiz Diaz seeing the game out with a goal in the 82nd minute in that dominant victory by the Sounders. Down in Portland earlier this evening, Yimi Chara scored the only goal in the 13th minute. The Sounders had the bulk of possession and some dangerous opportunities, but were unable to convert despite having the better of the expected goals in this match.
Ah.
The Timbers moved even in the Western Conference standings. The two Northwest rivals are tied for first in the West right now, but the Sounders still have a match in hand and lead the West with 1.75 points per match right now. We learned on Tuesday the remainder of the MLS schedule. The league will continue playing regional games through the duration of the 22-game regular season. The Sounders will mix it up with a few new opponents. They've added a home-and-home series against the Colorado Rapids and a home-and-neutral series with the Vancouver Whitecaps, who will continue to play their home games at Providence Park in Portland with the border between the U.S. and Canada closed.
So we're playing another game in Portland?
So many games in Portland. There's another game against the Timbers in Seattle, but also, yes, a third trip to Portland in these last couple months here.
I'll tell you what, the players can feel that they're in Portland.
It's unclear who will be more bothered by that, the Sounders or the Whitecaps. According to the SBI projections, the Sounders the most likely team to finish first in the West, doing so 40% of the time. Also, the Sounders making some news off the pitch is they brought back left back Brad Smith, who was a part of last year's MLS Cup champion team. Smith's loan from Bournemouth expired at the conclusion of the 2019 MLS season. Wait, you have something there?
Bournemouth. Bournemouth? You know how it's pronounced. You don't think it's pronounced Bournemouth? No, Bournemouth. Come on.
He spent the remainder of the year on loan to Cardiff City in the Championship.
This is why it's good that we're recording this video now.
Yes. You couldn't have done that. You could only have done that if we were in person or with video, freeing him to sign with the Sounders. O.L. Reign will be back in action for the first time since the NWSL Challenge Cup, which feels like many, many years ago. On Saturday, they play at the Utah Royals FC, traveling back to Salt Lake City. That'll be on 12:30 p.m. on CBS All Access. The Royals lost 3-0 on Sunday to the Portland Thorns in their opening game of the NWSL Fall Series, and Utah lost on PKs in the quarterfinals of the NWSL Challenge Cup, same as the Reign. Seattle Storm had an eventful week, to say the least. Game one of the WNBA semifinals against the Minnesota Lynx was all set for Sunday afternoon on ABC, but was postponed after three inconclusive COVID-19 tests for Storm players came back the day of the game. And as WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert explained, when you had those multiple tests, it raised the possibility that there was spread within the Storm, so they had to postpone that game, remove those players, put them in isolation, and continue testing. And the protocols in the WNBA, which have been tested a few times, because there's been, I think there were three inconclusive tests for individual players over the course of the regular season, require that you return two negative tests separated by at least 24 hours to prove basically that those inconclusive tests were false results. Two of those players, to my understanding, did so on Monday, and one, they did not get the second negative test back until Tuesday afternoon, hours before the Storm began the series. Wow. With game one.
You had us a little bit concerned here with this one, because my initial instinct was this is just an issue with testing. And understanding that there was a batch of tests that came back inconclusive, that's what the case was. It still feels like when teams are in these bubbles, it's pretty foolproof. We have not really seen any issues, even if it's a modified bubble, similar to what the NFL was doing, right? The NFL is not in a bubble, but they're doing their best to keep the players bubbled as much as possible, and even that seems to be working. So somebody getting into the WNBA bubble and testing positive and spreading to teammates would have been pretty surprising to me.
Oh, it would have been an enormous news story if it was the case, but you can sort of read between the lines if two of those players were able to...
I don't know how the news covers the WNBA. It's an enormous news story.
When there's controversy, they cover the WNBA. When things are going normally, not so great in terms of coverage. At least outside of this podcast. And, you know.
Wow. Patting yourself on the back there.
Yeah. Real self-aggrandizing. The fact that two of the players were able to return to the team and be part of shoot around on Tuesday, and one of the players wasn't cleared until Tuesday afternoon, you can sort of read between the lines that the initial test that player took did not come back negative. Mm-hmm. So that obviously would have led to a concern that player did in fact have an active case, which has proved...
Do we know who that was?
That has not been made public because of HIPAA.
Okay.
So we don't know who any of the three players were. I mean, it's kind of an odd thing to keep private now, to the extent that it's not like they did anything wrong. They just had something go wrong with their tests, but that has not been made public at all. Okay. So anyways, the Storm, after all that, a just wild 48 hours, ended up with a full roster for game one against Minnesota and played a thrilling game. Both teams super hot from three-point range despite a long, a little bit of a layoff. Minnesota had played on Thursday to make it to this semifinal round. The Storm had not played since the previous Sunday, so it had been, 8 days off in between games here. Still shot the ball really well. seemed like they were, the rotations were not quite there defensively. That was what Gary Kloppenberg, their coach, mentioned when I asked about, you know, where he saw rust, and some of the decision making on offense wasn't great. So, and they struggled with Breanna Stewart on the bench. They were minus 13 in the minutes that she spent on the bench, which wasn't very long. Stewie and Subert were both coming back from injuries, but were able to play normal minutes. Stewie played 34 minutes. Subert played 28 minutes in this game, which was, you know, probably even a slight benefit. They were scheduled to play on Sunday, but even a slight benefit of things being pushed back. But so still the Storms trailed by one were tied, I should say, in the closing seconds of this game, after Nafisa Collier, who was just terrific for Minnesota, scored to tie things up. And it was Alicia Clark who saved the day, a play that Sammy Whitcomb drove to the basket, missed, got a nice opportunity, but missed, and Alicia Clark was there to come up with the offensive rebound and the putback as the buzzer sounded, a thrilling win for the Storm.
Huge!
Yeah.
And exciting. You have to warn me that this game is on.
Sorry.
When is game two?
Game two is Thursday at 4:30 p.m. on ESPN2.
Right. There we go.
So be ready. I mean, I sent out the tweet with 2 minutes left. Did you at least get that?
No.
I feel like other people noticed that one. One of the things that happened in game one of the series is that Minnesota center Sylvia Fowles, the former MVP, did not play due to a calf injury. She'd missed pretty much the bulk of the second half of the season before coming back to play in their, I guess that's a quarterfinal game at that point, the one-and-done game that they had to win to get into this matchup. And Minnesota really struggled badly with Sylvia Fowles on the floor in that game. So it was a pretty big adjustment because they've gone small in her absence and put a lot more shooting on the floor, including Bridget Carleton, who just went wild from three-point range against the Storm in this game, was a big factor in why Minnesota, you know, had a chance to steal it. Fowles, you know, is a dominant defensive force, a physical presence in the post, but, you know, it's a different style when she's in there. So it'll be interesting to see whether she plays going forward and how that adjusts things for Minnesota. One of the things that really changes for the Storm is Alicia Clark's defensive matchup, which is something we've been watching since she's perhaps the favorite at this point to win Defensive Player of the Year.
Wow, there we go.
If Fowles plays, Clark will probably have to defend Nafisa Collier, who's kind of more of a combo forward type. Since she didn't play in Game 1, Clark defended Crystal Dangerfield, who's a 5'6" point guard. So that's like the versatility Alicia Clark is bringing at the defensive end of the court, in addition to making game-winning shots and posting the best true shooting percentage in the WNBA.
Wow, there we go, Alicia Clark. So how are things set up for the Storm now? This first round is a best-of-three series?
This is best-of-five, the semifinals.
And how are things looking elsewhere around the WNBA playoff bracket?
So on the other side of the bracket, Las Vegas, who got the number one seed by beating the Storm in the final game of the regular season, they were facing number seven Connecticut, who knocked off L.A., actually had a pair of upsets to get to this point, but knocked off the number two seed L.A. to make it to the semifinals in one of the biggest upsets and since they've gone to this format, they're the first number seven seed to get all the way to the semis. And carried on that hot streak by beating Las Vegas in game one as the Aces really struggled offensively in that one that was played just before the Storm was set to play game one. The Aces rallied to take game two narrowly, and part of the reason they were able to do so is one of Connecticut's star players, Alyssa Thomas, left the game with a shoulder injury, and she's not expected now to play in game three. So the Aces in much better shape going forward, certainly.
So things still potentially poised for an Aces Storm finals. I mean, that's what we're looking for here, right?
It's the most likely scenario, but it doesn't look like it's going to be as easy for either of those teams to get there as you would have kind of expected going into these series, since they had really separated themselves from the rest of the league. And I guess I called LA the two seed. They were the three seed, but they got knocked off. They were the next best team after the Storm.
Is Kelsey Plum healthy and playing?
No, she's out for the year. She had a ruptured Achilles.
Okay.
So one of the reasons what the Aces have done is pretty remarkable is that they're without her. So we will continue to follow the Storm as they continue to progress in the playoffs. Speaking of UW with Kelsey Plum, Let's talk.
I was like, were we?
Let's talk Husky football.
You mentioned Sammy Whitcomb earlier.
That's true. Yeah. They're the two WNBA players from UW. The Pac-12 CEO group is planning to vote Thursday on the possibility of a late fall football season. By all accounts, they will vote to play, and the question is really whether teams will be allowed to start on October 31st or all programs will start play on November 7th.
What does the CEO group mean?
It's basically like the presidents of the universities.
I love the idea of a CEO group of nonprofits.
It's, you know, look, it's all about the student athlete experience.
Oh, yeah. You know, they get paid in education, and that's really what's most important.
The Huskies, according to Jim Rick, are set to start practice on Tuesday either way, and he said they would be ready if the season started October 31st, although he seems to prefer November 7th as a start date. John Wilner, who's kind of the foremost expert of the Pac-12 in the media sphere, tweeted he thinks an October 31st start is slightly more likely, but that's what we'll really be learning, I think, tomorrow when this vote occurs.
Are there hurdles that need to be faced with schools in the states of California and Oregon at this point, or is that approved?
As I understand it, Oregon is good. The Oregon schools are good to go. The Southern California schools are good to go. The only issue would be the Bay Area schools, because one of the things that ended up doing after there was a weird contentious back and forth between California Governor Gavin Newsom and Larry Scott last week, it's 2020, man. I don't know. Is that basically California put it in the hands of the local officials rather than at the state level to determine when teams are allowed to practice and
are we
what restrictions.
That we want the Northern California schools back in the Pac-12.
You want to just throw Cal and Stanford out?
This is a serious question.
How dare you?
What are the implications here of, I'm assuming that the start date, October 31st vis-a-vis November 7th, isn't a big deal. Is the expectation that we know that the Big Ten is starting up again? Obviously, we know that all the conferences that don't care about their student athletes, even in the slightest, are basically already playing football.
When they're able to, when there's not an active outbreak on their teams or possibly spreading it to other teams.
Mm-hmm. I said conferences. No, that's an independent. So,
That's fair.
Is the expectation that we're going to have a quote-unquote normal bowl season now? We're going to have basically are we going to have the New Year's Six bowls, right? Are we going to have a playoff of four teams?
Yes. I mean, there's no way it's going to be a normal bowl season because the final game that the Pac-12 teams are going to play is going to be on December 19th. Like, that's when the bowl season usually was in full swing. Like, that's about when the Huskies played in the Las Vegas Bowl last year. So it won't be completely normal.
It'll be pushed back.
But the selection committee, like the CFP committee, is deciding December 20th, the day after that.
Oh, really? Okay. So this is all decided. Pac-12 is going to be done by December 19th. All conferences will have played. The SEC, ACC, Big 12 will have had a more normal break than the other conference, than the Big 10 and the Pac-12 have had. They'll be playing later, and then bowl season will happen probably in January, February.
Yeah, so I guess the idea here is, in all likelihood, the Pac-12 teams will play a six-game season. And then the seventh game will be the Pac-12 championship game, and then also it would be a crossover of all the other matchups. So, like, if you're second in the North, you would play second in the South, and so on and so forth.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So the 31st, the 7th, the 14th, the 21st, the 28th, December, math.
Oh, no. You ran out of fingers.
Going 28 with a 30-day month, so December 5th, I want to guess?
Sure.
12th, 19th. I'm counting eight games.
Well, that's what you were counting an October 31st start, right?
Yes.
Which not all schools are going to be able to make that. So
definitely not all Pac-12 schools are going to be able to make that.
Yes.
That is confirmed.
I mean, I think basically the restrictions in Northern California are believed to be, at least they'll be stringent enough that those teams won't be ready to play until November 7th.
They're like, we've got to get through Halloween first. We've got to yeet the tree, and then we can start playing college football.
Either you will see those teams building a bye that start October 31st, if that's what's approved, building a bye to their schedule, or there is some thought that possibly you could try to play a non-conference game against the school that was willing to agree to the same testing protocol that we're seeing in the Pac-12.
Which the other schools could find, you know, a Montana or whatever, Portland, I guess not. A Portland. Somebody like that would play.
Portland has not played football in a while. Portland State.
You know what I'm saying, though. Somebody like that. Look, as long
maybe
as
you can say again.
I don't care.
The Huskies will not have defensive tackle Levi Onwuzurike, who announced that he is opting out of the 2020 season ahead of the NFL draft. In all Pac-12 first-team selection in 2019, Onwuzurike is currently ranked the number 4 defensive tackle in the 2021 draft by Mel Kiper.
Are we sure that this is going to be the case? Because I think we've seen this sort of thing happen with players who initially opted out, and then once the season is happening, they sort of relented. I know this is something that they've seen at some of the SEC schools. He made this announcement before the Pac-12 officially announced that they were coming back.
But after it was well known that they were coming back, I think his eyes were open to what was going to happen.
Okay.
So I would not expect him to play. And look, at this point, I think we've talked about this before. There's, you know, whether it's a semi-traditional fall season or a spring season, there's not necessarily a lot for some of these players to gain.
I mean, I don't think I really understood. It's like this with both Joe Tryon and Levi Onwuzurike. I don't think I realized that they were rated that highly nationally.
Right.
So for Levi, it's like, damn, all right, dude.
Good for you.
Yeah. I mean, the Huskies are losing a lot of depth defensively, right? Especially in that front seven by not having any of those players playing. So the all smalls should be there. They're going to fill it in. And I feel like UW has quite a bit of depth in that front seven.
Do you feel like don't have the quality? I mean, it's gonna be a loss, but you know.
I mean, if you're losing that. Two players who would have been, you know, first possibly 2-day draft picks, like obviously that's a huge loss. I guess just on principle overall, how do we feel about the Pac-12 playing football?
I think that if you're able to test daily, I mean, that's a similar standard to what we're seeing in the NFL. You know, these campuses aren't generally places where, you know, there's not in-person instruction going on like there is in a lot of these other conferences. So you're not exposing the players to the risk of catching the virus, you know, in some lecture hall and then taking it to the football field. So with those parameters, I think it's ethically okay.
Okay.
The athletic department, by the way, announced that after a couple of weeks, I think, of having no positive results, they currently have they had 3 positive results in the most recent round of testing, so 3 active cases. So, I mean, overall, the numbers have been very good, but obviously players haven't been, you know, practicing. There's not been the ability to transmit it in a large group yet, so... But there's also not been the degree of testing that we're going to see going forward.
I'm just going to throw this out there. Players have been around each other. Like, the reality is, look, I've been at Hazen High School. I've seen how many kids are on a football field together, not social distancing. Like, there's no way that the UW football players are not around each other.
I don't know. There's a little more adult supervision at UW, I would say. I don't think they're just going out on Husky Stadium.
Kids at Hazen High School are definitely supervised by adults. But the reality is...
Okay, there's a little more... There's larger repercussions for those adults.
The stakes are obviously higher. But the reality is... The players are still getting together and whether we know it officially or not, this is what's happening. Players are hanging out with each other. I do not believe that everybody has been completely separate from everybody else, and there hasn't been a high degree of transmission. I think with the testing, where it's at, I mean, the Pac-12, in as much as you can do this right, has done this right. They didn't rush things. There's not going to be fans there. They didn't say this needs to happen on the normal schedule or 2 weeks later, right? They said, we're going to get our shit together. We're going to make a plan first, and then we're going to play college football. And you know what? They're still going to be involved in the college football playoff. Same as everybody else.
Well, they may be involved in the college football playoff, same as the last 3 years.
They have the chance to be involved in the college football playoff, same as everybody else. But, like, this is, I think, despite everything that I have said about college football over these last couple of months, if everybody else is going to do it, then, I mean, they kind of got peer pressured, right? Like, everybody, I think that the Pac-12 and the Big Ten, when they were like, we're done, we're not playing. I think they thought that the dominoes would fall from there and everybody was going to agree to play a spring season. When they didn't, those two conferences really got put in a difficult position, because if you're not playing an entire season, everybody else is, you put the history of your program at stake.
You're more convinced of that idea than I am. I think that they, I mean, I guess it's probably the appropriately cynical view that, you know, you're only willing to sacrifice so much for the welfare of your student athletes. But I do think that they cared about their players in a different way than these other conferences.
Oh, I mean, I suppose I agree with that also, but, like, I think that if they didn't come back at some point this year, there could have been very negative repercussions for these schools in both the Big Ten and in the Pac-12. I think there could have been long-term repercussions. So they're coming back. They're doing what they can. People are just going to – they're going to watch these games from Halloween through December, and then they're going to see what happens. And then we'll start it over with a more appropriate season in 2021.
Gonna knock on all the wood that's going to happen, and that UW will be playing at Michigan next year. I don't know what this means for Let's Remember a Season with the 2000 Huskers, but we're pressing on this week.
Yeah, we carried. I do want to say – just on a selfish personal level, it's going to be kind of fun. If there's Halloween and there's a Husky game, like, you know, at this point, I'm boycotting college football. But at the same time, I just don't really care about the other conferences. I'm boycotting football because I don't give a shit about these schools.
My interest in college football is extremely regional. Is the way I would put it.
I assume that there are games happening. The only game that I know about happening was involving Notre Dame, and it was the one that was canceled. I literally do not know what is happening throughout the college football world and do not care. But on October 31st, if we're getting Pac-12 After Dark on Halloween night, fucking sign me up. Like, come, you know that that's going to be fun.
I have a few distinct Halloween football memories from my childhood, and one of them is October 31st, 1992. The number two Huskies were hosting Stanford, a 41-7 win that pushed their winning streak to, like, I don't know, like 25 games, I think, at that point, including the undefeated 91 season. But of seeing, like, watching the broadcast of this game and seeing fans in Halloween costumes in the stands and thinking how remarkable that was. That's, like, a very distinct memory for me as a kid.
If this would have been a normal Halloween night and the Huskies, I don't even know if the Huskies would have been home for this game, but it would have been, I either wouldn't have been able to go because I have small children, or it would have been a very fun night.
I think you had me at you wouldn't have been able to go. Anyways, the 2000 Huskies, were after a bye week, were jumping ahead to week 5, in which they traveled to face number 20 Oregon as the 6th-ranked team in the country. Scouting the opponent, quarterback Joey Harrington entered his junior year after taking over the starting job from A.J. Feely.
Wow.
During his sophomore season. They had incoming J.C. transfer Mo Morris at running back, future Seahawk.
Seahawk legend, that is.
Such a big Mo Morris fan. A receiving core led – we don't talk enough about Mo Morris on the pod. A receiving core led by Keenan Howery. Not a lot of big names on defense. The Ducks started the season unranked and lost 27-23 at number 5 Wisconsin in week 2.
Why does Oregon play Wisconsin so much? What is with that? Is that like the UW-Michigan relationship?
I guess so. Beat number 6 UCLA 29-10 at home in their Pac-10 opener to enter the rankings for the first time behind 139 yards, I should say, on 37 carries.
Which was the early 2000s. They were pounding that rock.
I mean, 37 carries is enough. And 2 touchdowns from Mo Morris. The Ducks pretty much dominated the first 3 quarters of this game. The Huskies' only score was a 38-yard John Anderson field goal in the first quarter. The offense finally got on track in the fourth quarter with a 98-yard touchdown drive, followed by a 5-play drive to make it 23-16 with 4:08 remaining. The Huskies got the ball back with more than 2 minutes left, but turned the ball over on downs and did not get back until the final seconds of this one. It was a rough day for both quarterbacks. Tui went 14 of 37.
This is wild.
And Joey Harrington, in the win, completed 9 of his 22 pass attempts. Mo Morris had 31 carries for 152 yards. How the rest of the season went, the Ducks started the Pac-12 play 7-0 before facing Oregon State in the matchup formerly known as the Civil War. And if we continue this conceit, that game will come up in a prominent way later in the year.
Wow, I freaking can't wait. I was in the state of Oregon when that game happened.
Oh yeah, you mentioned that. I was in Pullman waiting for the Apple Cup, watching that game in the Cub.
In the Cub, these numbers are insane. It was 14 of 37.
The air raid, all of those concepts had not come to college football yet.
I mean, these were different times. Tarun was a second round draft pick, I want to say.
I think third.
Maybe third. Second or third. These were 2 quarterbacks. Joey Harrington was number 3 overall. And Tui was a second or third round draft pick. And they put up these numbers. The early 2000s were a wild time for quarterbacking. Now Gardner Minshew just has perfect games and we don't even care in the NFL.
Tui was a second round pick. It was not a great second round pick for the record. Love you, Tui.
He played some games.
He sure did play some games. How many games do you think Marcus Tuiasosopo started in his NFL career?
I'm going to guess that he started 8 games in his NFL career.
He started 2.
Really? That's all? Yeah. Wow, I'm shocked by that. Was he was behind Rich Gannon?
That sounds right.
These numbers are just, they really, it's hard to even view them through a modern prism.
That is correct.
And by the time Mo Morris got to Seattle as a running back, he'd already been freaking... You mentioned when you were doing your fantasy football numbers for running backs, that running backs peak when they're 5 years old. I have children who are past their prime as running backs right now.
I think there's some danger in extrapolating outside the data set there, but
that was the implication. Actually said.
In terms of yards per carry. By the way,
Marco is turning 6 this weekend and he is leaving his prime as a running back. Mobile ran ball 37 times when he was probably like 20.
Tui was behind Rich Gannon at the start of his career, but also Rick Meyer started 8 games in 2003 for the Raiders, and then the next 2 years their starting quarterback was Kerry Collins.
Oh, hey, put some respect on Super Bowl winner Kerry Collins' name.
I will do no such thing.
Rick Meyer, wow. But the idea that a running back would have 37 carries in a game is just like, it was a different era. And then 31 the following week.
In 2006, the starting job was split between Aaron Brooks and Andrew Walter.
He was the third string quarterback?
Yep. Yeah, so there you go. Marcus Tuiasosopo. Let's talk about the Seahawks.
All right.
2-0 heading into Sunday, a thrilling matchup with the Dallas Cowboys, who were very close to being 0-2. We'll talk about that in a second. Look, Don't make fun of me. First, let's start with some Seahawks news updates. Not good news on the injury front. Marquise Blair, we haven't actually heard what injury he has, but it's season ending. He was placed on IR, as was Bruce Irvin, who tore his ACL, and it was as bad as we feared. You're speechless over these injuries.
I didn't know if you wanted me to jump in there. I mean, it sucks. I really don't know what to say. Like, this is Marquise Blair's season to have really broken out. You know, he was on the field as a nickel corner. He was on the field as a third string safety. Like, this was the year that Marquise Blair was really going to emerge and then find a starting job eventually.
Yeah, it's very disappointing. And then, you know, with the Seahawks depth at pass rush, losing Bruce Irvin is a huge loss.
And what also, I mean, if we're being cynical, the money that they're paying to Bruce Irvin, you know, they, to be honest, overpaid Bruce Irvin to come back this offseason. And to have him, to lose him in the second game is pretty brutal because, you know, part of the reason that Jadeveon Clowney is not on this team is because of the contract that they offered to Bruce Irvin. And you can't predict an injury. That's fine. And I'm not saying that the money would have been spent better by paying to Jadeveon Clowney because he could have gotten hurt too. So, right. But it is like, it's a factor here. And we haven't really seen much of anything. I don't even know if I've seen him make a play at all from Benson Mayoa. Can you remember Benson Mayoa making a play?
I thought he was involved in pressuring Matt Ryan at one point in a play where Matt Ryan threw the ball away, or maybe the intentional grounding that Matt Ryan took was Mayoa's pressure.
Okay. Yeah, it's just, you know, Mayoa hasn't really popped so far.
He also ended up not practicing or limited in practice on Wednesday, so that was discouraging. Cool. Yeah, broke Tristan.
You know, LJ Collier made that huge play at the end of the game, and we're going to have to see a lot more. The pass rush, it's an issue at this point. I don't think that run defense is an issue, and that's pretty interesting. But as far as getting to the quarterback, like, Cam Newton had all day back there. Matt Ryan had all day back there. And Dak Prescott will have all day to pass, which is not ideal, in my opinion. I wouldn't be shocked if in the next 3 to 4 weeks we see some sort of move made to bolster the defensive line, in particular the pass rush. We haven't seen Shaquem Griffin get the call up. I thought that was something that we were going to see this week because, you know, in that playoff game, Shaquem Griffin was maybe the Seahawks' best pass rusher.
Yeah, I thought so too. They did not add outside defensive line. They did add a defensive tackle with Anthony Rush joining the roster, the 53, after he was called up from the practice squad last week.
How perfect is that name for a pun? For a run-stopping defensive tackle, Anthony Rush.
It is quite outstanding.
It's just insufferable for you.
She made a Bridget Carl ton of threes. Yeah, I don't know if you were exposed to that. I threw that up there on Cape Elton WPP.
This is Bridget Carlton is her name?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. I'll find the links. Mayoa missed practice with a groin injury, according to the injury report. And then Rasheem Green also remains sidelined in practice with a neck injury that caused him to miss week two. So he's another person who, you know, ideally will factor into that pass rush depth, but possibly not this week, which means DeAndre Walker, maybe? I don't know.
And we've heard nothing on second round pick from Tennessee, right?
Sounds like it's going to be a while.
I feel like it might be a while for Shane Green, too. The Seahawks have not had good luck with stingers.
Yeah, you never know with those injuries. It's Daryl Taylor, by the way.
Daryl Taylor.
The Seahawks second-round pick who has yet to return to practice as he works back from the injury that sidelined him in the draft process.
So I guess on the injury front, I think that the Seahawks have enough depth in the secondary to overcome the Blair injury. The Bruce Irvin injury is a pretty big question. You know, there's talks. They did draft a linebacker in the first round this year, and Jordan Brooks is going to have to do some things.
He's going to start.
So you know, we'll see what happens. They did draft a couple of linebackers last year. It seems like BBK and Cody Barton are more special teams players at this point, who probably, if they're on the field during the run of play, should be a play to spell somebody for a second, that they're not probably consistent playing linebackers.
I mean, I think both of those guys, Barton, I think, has a better chance of, you know, seeing defensive snaps, but I think both of those guys probably would make more sense if Bobby Wagner were to miss some time.
Yeah.
You know, than Irvin, who's playing a pretty different role, I would say, in the Seahawks defense. So they also placed Philip Dorsett on IR, which means he will miss at least 3 weeks. You know, he has not played in either of the first two games due to a foot injury. And the last bit of news is that Pete Carroll, among five coaches, fined in week two for not wearing their mask during games.
You could just see it coming. So the Philip Dorsett injury, I mean, I thought the Philip Dorsett signing was a bit of a strange signing. But there hasn't been a moment where we've said to ourselves, I mean, Russ has been basically perfect this year, but there hasn't been a moment that we've said to ourselves, there need to be more receiving options. Like, Josh Gordon would be a luxury at this point.
I do not agree with that, and here's why. Is even though David Moore has played really well so far this season, the Seahawks have not used him to rest DK Metcalf or Tyler Lockett whatsoever. If you look at the snaps,
if I heard any Freddie Swain slander, I was about to go off.
Absolutely,
there
not.
Shall be no Freddie Swain slander on Swain this podcast.
So far, the Seahawks have run 125 offensive plays. Do you want to guess how many of those DK Metcalf has been on the field for?
124.
Tyler Lockett has been on the field for 118.
He came back. That is not... When he got into a fight on the sidelines, DK Metcalf was on the field right after that, which I was kind of shocked about.
That is not a sustainable rate of using those two guys.
I think the Patriots took Stephon Gilmore out for a play, and the Seahawks left DK Metcalf in.
David Moore has played 52% of snaps, is basically exclusively the third wide receiver, and then Swain has played 22% of snaps with one snap thus far for Penny Hart.
Josh Gordon will come back.
I hope so.
It'll happen. We won't know when it happens. Well, we'll know when it happens.
We can't predict.
We will have no forewarning when it happens.
We know not the time nor the season. Should we talk about the Cowboys? I don't know if you're aware of this. They have a new coach, Mike McCarthy, our old friend from the 2014/15 NFC Championship game, replaced Jason Garrett as head coach after a hard luck season for the Cowboys, who went 8-8 with an expected record of 11-5. Dallas lost McCarthy's debut 20-17 at the Rams in the opening of SoFi Stadium in week one, and then were staring 0-2 in the face, down 20-0 after the first quarter, having lost three fumbles, and 39-24 to Atlanta last week with 8:01 left in the game. They then scored two touchdowns in a 3-minute-and-10-second span, followed by a successful Greg Zuerlein onside kick, or maybe just a really unsuccessful Atlanta attempt to recover, said Greg Zuerlein.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm going to give... I mean, it was a nice onside kick by Greg Zuerlein, I suppose.
Which set up a 46-yard Zuerlein field goal to win behind 450 yards and three rushing touchdowns from Dak Prescott. The Cowboys, after 2 weeks, number 14 in DVOA so far, number 9 in Dave, which is Football Outsiders metric, that combines DVOA rating to date with your projected rating entering the season.
75% projected rating, 25% current.
Oh, wow, well, there you go.
That's the Dave, I suppose.
Yeah, Seahawks number 2 so far in DVOA, ranking 2nd in offense, 1st in special teams. Shouts Michael Dixon, and 24th in defense, and they're number 5 in Dave. Which still is a strange name because it just makes me think of the Kevin Kline movie?
Oh!
I feel like we probably make this reference every year.
The Kevin Kline vehicle. is what we like to call it. Looking at that Cowboys game, against Atlanta, it was really an interesting one because I was looking at it statistically, and it feels like the Falcons outplayed the Cowboys in every way.
You think so?
Well, I mean, you look at it and you say, okay, the Cowboys were lucky to have won this game. Like, they needed a miracle to win this game. The Falcons were consistently ahead the entire game. Every time we checked in on it, the Falcons were up by two scores. But the Cowboys just kept coming and kept coming and kept coming. And I have to say,
The Cowboys scored. They had 50% more yards than the Atlanta Falcons. Precisely 50%.
There's game script explanation for that, right?
Like, sure, but also the reason they were down is because they fumbled three times and missed a fourth down in the first quarter. Like,
scored those points.
It was always obvious that they were going to come back in this game. It was just a question of whether they were going to run out of time or not. And, I mean, they couldn't stop Atlanta necessarily.
That's the thing that I'm saying, though, is I think that Atlanta, the reason that they lose all of these close games and are susceptible to large comebacks, I think they're really bad at this. Like, this is... I love Dan Quinn.
This being defense?
No, Todd Gurley had 21 carries, I want to say, in that game for, like, 60 yards. It's just like, dog, fucking run your offense, dude. You've got Matt Ryan playing against no corners. You have Calvin Ridley roasting the secondary. Like, keep doing that. And I have to say, the Falcons let him off the hook.
I mean, they did score their final two drives. I believe they scored touchdowns, didn't they? Oh, they punted their final drive. They had a field goal and a touchdown in the two drives before that.
They didn't. There's no reason that Todd Gurley should have 21 carries in any football game in the year 2020. There's no explanation for it, and there's no reason for it.
I'm aware that other people have different views of Todd Gurley's ability than I do, but they passed on 2nd and 12 on that final drive. Matt Ryan was sacked, which is a very rare. They actually passed on both 2nd and 12 and 3rd and 18. Did not. They just picked up 10 yards on the 3rd and 18. A Matt Ryan sack is a very rare thing in 2020 for the Cowboys, as we'll talk about in a minute.
But this could be a very similar game. I mean, you look at it, and obviously the Seahawks played the Falcons. Cowboys played the Falcons. I think the Cowboys defense actually did better against the Falcons somehow in a game that it was a miracle for them to have won.
Against the transitive property.
They did better against the Falcons offense than the Seahawks did. But I think what we should expect here this weekend is that ball's going to be flying down the field in this game. And I don't know if either team can stop the other team on offense.
Well, that is possible. They did hold Matt Ryan to 7.6 yards per attempt, down from the 8.3 yards per attempt that he had against the Seahawks. Dak Prescott, 18th so far in completion percentage over expectation and 14th in EPA per play among quarterbacks. He finished 5th in EPA per play last season, just ahead of Russell Wilson, although about the same spot in CPOA at 17th. Really, his play hasn't changed that much. The issue is just largely that offense has been really good so far this season. Ezekiel Elliott comes in 16th in DR so far, the Football Outsiders value metric. He's right about average in DVOA per play market, held down in part by the fact that he's fumbled twice in the first two games of the season, which has been a general problem for the Cowboys. Some interesting results from the Cowboys receivers in DR. CeeDee Lamb, their rookie out of Oklahoma, leads the Cowboys receivers, followed by Michael Gallup. Their average targets have gone for 11 and 10.8 yards, respectively, as compared to 7.9 for leading receiver Amari Cooper.
They are shoving that ball into Amari Cooper.
The once vaunted Cowboys offensive line has been pretty average this season. Center Travis Frederick retired at age 29, and right tackle Lyle Collins is on IR with a hip injury, while left tackle Tyron Smith missed Sunday's game with a neck injury and did not practice on Wednesday. So his status will be worth monitoring this week. The Cowboys are 18th in pass defense DVOA, and 13th in rush defense. They are just 26th so far in ESPN's pass rush win rate stat, with two sacks this season, one apiece for Eldon Smith, who is back after an extended absence, a long time out of the league, and then Everson Griffin, who got that sack on Matt Ryan that was crucial last week and then celebrated the onside kick in memorable fashion. Those have been his most notable contributions since signing away from Minnesota this offseason. It's someone that we thought the Seahawks might pursue if they did not sign Jadeveon Clowney, but no such luck there. By the way, the last season for Aldon Smith in the NFL, 2015 in Oakland.
Wow. What I think most importantly when you look at the Cowboys is the injuries in particular, and facing this Russ cooking Seahawks offense, starting corners Trevon Diggs and Chidobe Awuzie both did not practice this week. Looks like possibly both won't play in this game.
Awuzie is out several weeks with a hamstring injury, so he definitely won't play. Diggs is more uncertain what his availability will be.
I don't really understand how the Cowboys are going to stop the Seahawks offense. The only thing that could stop the Seahawks offense this weekend is coming from the sky, and that is if rain touches Russell Wilson. But I'm not willing to buy into that that's even a factor anymore. I think that...
How are you not willing to buy into that that's a factor? Like, the last time we saw Russell Wilson play in rain was, what, the Arizona game?
He doesn't do well in gloom. Rain, I'm not willing to admit. I think Russell Wilson...
What's the difference?
There is a difference. It's a feeling. It's a vibe, and you know it's different. Look, we've been at those Cardinals games. It's not the same. It's not just raining when the Seahawks play the Cardinals. It's more than raining.
But you know what the forecast is looking up for Sunday?
There we go.
I have not looked at this since this morning.
Give me that forecast.
We have, at most at any point that day, according to Weather Underground, a 24% chance of rain, and that's in the morning.
Show me clear.
By kickoff time. An 11% chance of rain.
Oh, man.
There's a sun shining on there.
89% chance of Russ cooking on Sunday. The secondary cannot stop the Seahawks offense, right? They're not going to be able to stop the Seahawks pass game going against a battered down Cowboys secondary that has really not stopped the Rams or the Falcons before them. And they are going against the best quarterback in the NFL at this very moment. I don't understand how they're going to be able to do it, and especially if there's no pass rush happening.
I mean, there would be one other thing that would concern me, but it's probably too late for this to happen. And that would be if the Cowboys signed Earl Thomas.
Mm-hmm. What if the Seahawks signed Earl Thomas? Does that concern you? Which side does that concern you more on?
Oh, I mean, no, that would be very amazing, especially if they were playing him at nickel, or I guess Jamal Adams would play weak side linebacker with Bruce Irvin injured. Maybe I don't know exactly what the positionality would be, but I mean, I endorse it.
Look,
no matter what.
Make it happen, Schneids.
Now, if there's a concern for me about the Seahawks offense this week, it's this. The Cowboys are 30th in run stop win rate, so the Seahawks may be pretty excited about their ability to run in this one too.
Okay, sure. If you're actually worried that the Seahawks are going to run too much and do it effectively, then I'm not concerned about that. Like, this offense is going to move the ball against the Cowboys. There is no doubt in my mind. And also, Schneids, if Dan Gilbert can mend things with LeBron James, you too can with Earl Thomas. Bring him back!
I mean, I feel like it's more Pete Carroll.
Bring him back.
I don't know if Earl flipped off John Schneider directly.
He was flipping off the entire sideline.
Well, John Schneider's in the box. He's not on the sideline. But, I mean, it was just really... The message was intended.
It was the entire organization that he was flipping off. But this is the point that we're in this era of, again, every week that it happens, we feel more confident that it's going to continue happening. And I love that we're in this point where it's like Russ throws a pick and we're like, no, Pete, it's fine. It's fine. Keep cooking. Don't worry. It's okay. Like, that's the era that we're in. But against this Cowboys defense, I kind of see Shoddy doing his thing, you know? And if they run the ball and are successful running the ball, that's fine. Let them run the ball. The point of let Russ cook is not that if they run the ball and are successful, they shouldn't do that. It is don't do something that is unsuccessful over and over and over again.
Oh, so the 2018 playoff loss against the Cowboys.
And that's the real point here is like, They can do this. They've got a Cowboys team that is, albeit a pretty scary offense. The offensive line is not what it once was. Look, we might even see pass rush from the Seahawks team. I'm not convinced of it, but we might see it. The places that the Cowboys are weak are places that benefit the Seahawks, is what I'm saying. I'm not willing to write off the Seahawks secondary after 2 weeks. And I think a lot of people are doing that. I don't think this is a bad secondary.
I have hope that Quentin Dunbar will play better going forward.
I mean, he was number three. Look, the Pro Football Focus ratings have been proven to be better at predictive power than statistical analysis in a lot of ways. He was number three last year. Like, Quentin Dunbar, for all intents and purposes, should be a good cornerback. But also, he basically was not with the team for all of training camp.
Yeah, I mean, the counterpoint is he was number three in Washington football team scheme in a single season. That's not the same as being number three in the Seahawks scheme, trying to pick up the quick step, kick step, without a training camp, et cetera, et cetera. But
he doesn't.
He can't not play better.
Also, they were without Quandre Diggs for basically the entire game last week. And I feel like, how many times have we played Dak? It's getting up there. But like, Christmas Eve victory over the Cowboys. Did Dak start that one?
Probably.
We just comfortably beat the Cowboys on Christmas Eve a couple years ago. And it snowed. It was great.
I mean, that was the year the Seahawks didn't make the playoffs, right?
That particular game was great.
I'm not disputing that. This will be the third regular season matchup between the Seahawks and the Cowboys.
With a fourth playoff matchup. How many times have they played Cam Newton, and how many times have they played Matt Ryan?
A lot.
1,000 for each of them, in fact. Yeah. Scientifically speaking. There's something about the Seahawks offense, if you are comfortable and familiar with it, you can pick it apart. Or defense. That is the reality of the Seahawks defense. If you know it and you have seen it, there's always going to be holes. If there is a Julian Edelman that can find the hole and you're Cam Newton, you can stay comfortable, you can find that hole, you can pick apart the Seahawks defense. If this is your fourth time playing it, I'm not fully convinced of it. Matt Ryan and Cam Newton know the Seahawks defense better than almost any quarterbacks, including NFC West quarterbacks, in the league.
Yeah.
How about this? How many quarterbacks, amount of times having played the Seattle Seahawks, where do you think Cam Newton and Matt Ryan rank of quarterbacks currently in the NFL right now? Because they're higher than Kyler, they're higher than Jimmy G, they're higher than Jared Goff, right? How many quarterbacks do you think have faced the Seahawks defense more than Matt Ryan and Cam Newton? It's probably nobody.
They have probably played them the most among active NFL quarterbacks. I'm less convinced that explains everything.
It's a factor, though. Do you not agree that it's a factor?
I mean, that familiarity can run both ways, I suppose.
It never runs both ways. It only runs the opposing quarterback's way. Have you seen the Seahawks defense?
Well, sure. I think it's more true in Matt Ryan's case than it is in Cam Newton's case, because it's not like Cam Newton has been uniformly successful against the Seahawks in those previous matchups.
It's been kind of hit or miss for Cam.
Yes.
But
he was awesome against them in his MVP season.
And he looks quite healthy right now. Cam Newton understands the Seahawks defense. And I'm not sure if Dak is quite there to those two quarterbacks. Are you looking this up, how many times quarterbacks have played against the Seahawks defense?
Of course I'm looking this up. What do you think?
Okay, I'm just saying they have to be, if they're not at the top, they have to be near the top. Because we've seen those fuckers over and over and over again.
I mean, I'm looking in the Pete Carroll era, and I would assume that there's, like, you know, someone like Carson Palmer might be higher, who's retired.
Oh, we're not painting him this week.
Among active quarterbacks, Cam Newton has started 9 games against the Seahawks, including last Sunday. Matt Ryan, 8. Aaron Rodgers, 8. Jared Goff, 8. Also, depending whether you, if you want to count him as an active quarterback, Colin Kaepernick with 9.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. I can't even believe they're for 9. Like, even trying to think back on that is shocking. Anyway, subscribe to the Peltoncast Patreon to get behind-the-scenes audio of Kevin Pelton complaining while he tries to remember his Stathead password.
I had to go change it. Because the hint I gave myself via was did not register what I actually put there.
So. The hint was who's the active quarterback who's started the most games against the Seahawks in the Pete Carroll era, and you had no idea who because you couldn't get into Stathead. Anyway, so as you understand, Dak Prescott is not on this list. Right? These are quarterbacks who are so familiar. The Seahawks defense has not changed. The personnel has changed. Jamal Adams does change things. I can admit that.
I mean, Dak Prescott has started as many games as Matt Schaub, and that guy threw for 400 yards against the Seahawks last year.
Don't even get me started on Matt Schaub. No. Matt Ryan passed down his wisdom to Matt Schaub. There is something to the comfort in this. I'm not saying that they're going to do well against Dak Prescott here. I'm just saying I'm not willing to admit that this is like...
You're just saying you guarantee a victory.
100%.
Wow!
No.
Wow!
I'm not willing to go to the place. I think the Seahawks secondary is being underrated at this point. Like, man for man in the Seahawks secondary, I think they're good. I think that Shaquille Griffin is good. I think that Jamal Adams is good. I think Quandre Diggs is good. I think Quentin Dunbar is good. I think whomever is playing nickel corner is good. RAP Marquise Blair, we miss you. I think Ugo Amadi is a credible cornerback, though. Like, I'm not as convinced on Lano Hill, to be honest. But
I give Lano Hill a better chance than Ugo Amadi because Lano Hill wasn't just picked apart by Julian Edelman for like 2 quarters on Sunday.
A lot of people have been picked apart by Julian Edelman.
Wasn't that the most catchy, like, that was like a career high for him in something, wasn't it?
Hell of a game. Dude, seeing that Cam number, that this was the third highest passing yard total since his first and second games ever, that was wild. but I feel like the secondary is not a bottom 10 secondary.
Career high, 179 receiving yards for Julian Edelman. You want to guess what his previous high was?
132.
More than that, it was 151.
Alright. But there's also some game script action to it, and I think that is why Dak is going to have a monster game.
You're making me less confident about the Seahawks as you talk. Really? I was at a 60% chance of victory, but you being so confident in the Seahawks secondary has dropped me down to a 55.
I'm confident in the Seahawks offense. And I think that the Seahawks secondary will do just enough as they did against Cam Newton. I think the Seahawks offense puts up 40 points.
Not a lot of precedent for that.
I think they put up 30 plus points in this one. And the defense does just enough that they can... I think it could be a similar game to this Patriots game that we saw on Sunday.
That they nearly lost.
That they probably should have won by 2 scores, but ends up being slightly closer than it should. Than it should be, and they win it by, you know, 8 points or so.
So what's your chance of victory then?
74%.
Okay.
I mean,
I am taking it back to 60%. It's
okay.
It's sunny. It's partly cloudy, so that's a solid 60% chance of winning.
The Seahawks are one of the best teams in the NFL who've been playing like it. They have Russell Wilson. It's not supposed to rain. And they're going against a Cowboys team that is starting their third and fourth best cornerbacks. Like,
I don't know why you've ruled out this rookie cornerback based on the fact that he missed one day of practice.
I just ruled out based upon him being a rookie cornerback, because who cares? You're going against, they played the fucking defensive player of the year last week. Do you hear this? Stephon Gilmore ain't walking through that door for the Cowboys. That Patriots secondary, even without Patrick Chung, is better than the Cowboys secondary. They're not comparable. Like, these two defenses, the Patriots had one of the best defenses in the NFL last year, and the Seahawks fucking shredded them on Sunday night. Are you not aware that Russ is cooking? Have you not seen the chef hat? Do you not know that Shoddy is in the skybox?
What is skybox? It's press box. Skybox is a name for, like, a suite. Press box is where the offensive coordinators and the media said. Those are different things. Okay, that's my complaint rate number one. But number two, like, Russ is completing 83% of his passes this year. That is not a sustainable number. He's never in his career completed more than 68. Like, we gotta chill the fuck out a little bit here, guys.
To the mean. He'll be at 88 to 90% of his passes.
We gotta, like, remain the slightest bit calm here. Like, every time you get this excited about the Seahawks, something bad happens. They lose to Arizona.
Russell played this well.
I mean, I think the end of the 2015 season.
We'll always have the end of the 2015 season. It's our before sunrise and before sunset of the Seahawks. Like, that is, we will always come back to that. But Russell Wilson is playing football on another level right now, and it's not lucky.
It's not lucky, but that also does not, like, the two choices are not lucky and it's going to continue completely. Those are not the two options.
In DR, he had a negative 60 play, or sorry, negative 40 play, I want to say, the pick six was. And he still finished fourth in DR among quarterbacks. Like, against the Patriots defense. I'm sorry, but are you not aware of what Russell Wilson is doing right now? I'm not going to assume that it's going to go badly until it goes badly. Look, Russell Wilson is...
Have you never been a Seahawks fan before?
No, I'm a Russell Wilson fan, and shit goes well for Russell Wilson, right?
I mean, I can think of some times that things have not gone super great for Russell Wilson.
It is a different era. We're not cheering for friggin', like, Rick Meyer, right? Like,
I'm not talking a different era. I'm talking about three games ago when they played the Cardinals at home. It was not that.
I mean,
it
Cardinals.
Was before times,
if you
but
the Cardinals were at home, I'd be scared. This is different. When was the last time the Seahawks lost at home to the Cowboys?
There was definitely a home loss during to the Romo at some point in there. Isn't there? Now I'm going to have to find my password again.
Oh, no. The $5 tier. Oh, my God.
Oh.
How did you not stay logged in?
I'm still logged in. I was joking. That was a joke.
Good God.
They lost at home to Dallas in 2014, 30-23.
Well, I don't remember that.
Well, he remembers the last 2 weeks, apparently.
2014. Maybe that I think I kind of remember leaving that game and being pretty bummed. Was it early in the season?
October 12th, week 6.
Not really. Kind of right in the middle. Okay. I don't know. It's been a while. Like, I feel good about this particular matchup. I think the Cowboys are not as good of a team as they were hyped to be preseason. And you're taking a photo of me on the Skype for the BTS on the Patreon.
Oh, no, I've already done that.
Put it on the Discord.
Your memory is very short. That's all I have to say.
My memory extends back to Skybox and Shoddy And that's all I need to know. Oh, sorry. My memory also extends back to let Russ cook. And that is what's happening right now. And until Russ stops cooking, I'm not going to assume that the Seahawks are going to lose.
I got to say right now, what you remind me of is like Charlie Brown going up to kick that football. And you're like, look, Lucy's not going to move the football this time. I know she's moved the football so many times before the bench, but this time she's not going to move
it. We have two games of evidence here that Russ is cooking. Look, if it was one game, I was skeptical going into the Patriots game.
I have 40 years of Pete Carroll's coaching career as evidence over on my side.
Maybe kind of aggressive at USC.
I'm rereading Win Forever at the moment. Uh-huh. And there's descriptions of him going for various fourth downs. And like the game that they won at Notre Dame, the Bush push, they went for the touchdown there, even though they were down by three with like no time remaining. Instead of taking the field goal going to overtime, they went for the touchdown. Like, that is not a decision Pete Carroll would make in a million years now.
Look, you don't call it... Between your 70 and 80th year, you get a little bit more conservative. They don't call him Big Balls Pete for nothing, right? Like, he got that nickname for a reason. And it's very easy to also have that nickname when you have the most talent of anybody in the country, like a mile.
Yes.
But it does feel like I think their confidence in Russell Wilson is at the highest it has ever been in the Pete and Russ era.
Probably. We'll see.
I mean, you saw the quick reads this week, right? You've seen what Russ is doing. We're in historic territory.
I don't think that Pete saw the quick reads this week.
Do you think he doesn't know what Russell Wilson is doing right now? Is he like, you know what, those were nice games that we beat the Patriots and the Falcons?
I mean, it's not like Russ has never done this before and they haven't reverted back to their shell and fucking running on 2nd and 11.
Why? Like, why does that change?
Because like Russell Wilson didn't just get good 2 weeks ago.
He might lose this game because the offense might revert to 2019, 2018 status. Is that it? Okay, let me ask you this question.
And the defense is bad. Those are the two things. And they have a bunch of season-ending injuries. Like, I don't know why you pushed me into this place, but like a week ago you were talking about how the Seahawks were like a 51% chance to win to the Patriots, and now you're giving them like a 300% chance to win. You know, I can't deal with your wild swings of emotion.
We've seen 2 weeks of Russ cooking. Let me ask you a question here. If the Seahawks...
But you've seen a week of Russ cooking last week and you didn't think it? Like, what? Second week is all of a sudden that important?
Yes! You don't think it's that important? Look, we saw
I don't
even...
No, I don't think it's that important.
We saw the first half against the Falcons and I was still
I would need, like, four or five seasons of this to actually believe that the Seahawks' philosophy has changed.
Oh, my God. Let me ask you a question here. If the Seahawks let Russ cook against the Cowboys, what is your percentage chance of victory?
70?
From 60?
Yes.
Okay. So you think there is a good enough chance that they do not
let Russ cook last week, and again, they needed a stop at the 1 yard line to win the game. Granted, there was a pick six that was somewhat fluky that affected the score, but
somewhat
like shit happens in games. That's why you do percentage chances of victory.
I love that we're pushing each other in different directions. Well, I'm excited to see it. I just think this is a good opportunity for it. All that is to say, if they run the ball and they run the ball effectively, that's fine. I'm not concerned with this. Again, the point of letting Russ cook is not about just never running. It's about if running isn't effective, you should be passing the ball and passing on early downs and mixing it up. Like, if the offense is just humming and Chris Carson's getting 8 yards a carry, let him fucking run, right? Like, there's nobody who's against that as an idea. The point is, if you're running into a wall, if you're 2017, if Tom Cable is rehired as offensive line coach, like, there is a difference between that.
I don't know if you're aware of this. The last time the Seahawks played the Cowboys, they may not have let Russ cook. That may have been an issue for them.
I think they learned some things 2 years after that.
All right, on that.
We'll see what happens on Sunday. I would say fairly confidently that we'll be back with a post-game pod.
I mean, look, one way or another, there's going to be something to discuss post-game.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
I can't believe we ended up with a fight, too. Out of nowhere. God, the people are going to love it. Everybody's going to be on your side.
It's the right side.
Dumb.
Gee, nothing bad's going to happen. I don't know.
They got a miracle to beat the Falcons at home. Are you kidding me?
They fumbled three times and missed a fourth down in the first quarter alone.
They got it. They could not stop that.
You're putting way too much. You need to regress this to the mean.
They could not stop. The Seahawks killed the Falcons.
The Seahawks could not stop Matt Ryan either. It's just the Falcons were the ones that missed all the fourth downs in that game. Did you watch the game? Like, what you don't seem to understand is that there's an enormous difference in the NFL between the process that you, the quality with which you play in a game, and the observed results in that game.
Football Outsiders DVOA, which takes that out of the equation. And, or the Seahawks at number two?
They weren't at number two after the Falcons
game. You're trying to lecture me on this, but, like, the Seahawks are number two in DVOA, number five Dave in a scenario,
yeah,
and the Falcons are number two in Dave, which is, we all know, is fucking bullshit. Although actually I think the Saints are underrated.
Wait, the Falcons are number two?
The Saints are number two, sorry. The Falcons are are actually really bad. The Falcons are 11 in Dave, which is not bad. The Cowboys are 9.
5 versus 9 is not like a, well, we got this one in the bag.
What about 14-2?
But like, that's not the predictive one going forward. That's why Dave exists. Also, to pretend to be the president.
Dave in this DVOA roundup. Did you read that? He was basically just like, yeah, Dave, look, we understand Dave might not work this year.
I am very careful to throw things out.
I am too, but over time things will sort themselves out. I do think
those things that will be sorting themselves out is the Seahawks rushing on second and 13.